Welcome to The Sit Down, a mafia history podcast. Here's your host, Jeff Nadeau.
What's up, everybody, and welcome into another edition of The Sit Down, a mafia history podcast. Hope you're all having a great day wherever you are. This is episode 32, and we are back live another week, another show, another sit down. I am Jeff Nadeau. Hope you're having a good week. We are battening down the hatches. It's daylight savings time. It gets super dark now by like 4:30 or 5. It's really turning into winter slowly but surely. This week, we got a great show. We're going to head out to Chicago. Haven't been out to Chicago in a while. And we're going to talk about probably the weirdest person in the history of the mob. Definitely the most bizarre. And in my estimation, probably the biggest, I don't know, maniac, I guess you could say. We've definitely talked about some weird people: Anthony Casso, Carmine Galanti, Tommy Patera, Kabani Savage. It's funny. Well, it's not really funny, but someone on Twitter said to me, I said this show would be really graphic, and someone said, well, worse than Kabani. And I said, well, I don't know about as bad as Kabani, but he's pretty bad. We're going to talk today about Mad Sam DiStefano, probably teach you something. It is going to be graphic, so I urge you, if you have kids in the room, you probably shouldn't let them listen to the show ever, but there's going to be some very graphic parts of this show, but that's what we do. We talk about the mob. Let's bring in our co-host. We haven't talked to him in a while. He's been off for a couple of weeks doing some traveling, doing his thing. It's a great Blackjack Fletcher. Blackjack, how you doing? Good to talk to you.
I'm doing spectacular, buddy. Great to be back, as always. Looking forward to doing an episode with you. This one is, as you said, at points going to be a little disturbing, but, an interesting character nonetheless.
Yeah, a guy that, really did it all. I mean, we're talking about a guy that by the age of 35, had for most of his life, spent it in prison. And it really made him a better criminal. It's really one of those things where we look at the prison system, we say, well, it's supposed to rehabilitate. Sam DiStefano learned a lot of things, and really his reason for being and elevating in the outfit the way he did was his sheer connections to prison and becoming a better criminal. But by the end of it, the outfit just kind of grew tired of his behavior. But we'll get into all that and more. How you been, though? What's been up? How's everything going?
I've been doing great, buddy. I've been, traveling to Iowa for a college tour with Better Than Vegas, doing good. But realistically, I want to know how you're doing. How's your training been going? You got a big fight coming.
Oh, yeah, for the fight. Yeah, it's going good, Blackjack. I've been saying I've learned a lot from it. I think when you fight or you get into any kind of organized fighting, we have our way of, if we're in the street defending ourselves, but I never realized that I was throwing a punch the wrong way the entire time. I wasn't even standing the correct way. So, I've learned a lot. I mean, it's incredible what a trainer does for you.
So you've got this fight coming up now in just about a month from now.
Yeah.
How are you feeling about where you are as opposed to where this schmuck Jersey Jerry is?
I feel pretty good. I mean, the problem that we have, man, is that, when Miguel Cotto fights, Floyd Mayweather, I mean, they have a ton of tape on each other. Him and I don't have any tape on each other. We don't.
Well, the tape on him is limited, but it's bad.
Yeah. And as far as, you don't really put a ton of tape together in general. So it's, I feel confident. I feel confident in my own ability. I know my cardio is good and I know that I'm going to deliver the best I can. I think it's going to be enough to take care of business. He's a tough kid. I know he'll put time into it, but
he's not a tough kid. He's not a tough kid. You're being polite, and I am. You don't want to poke the snake, and that's a smart strategy, but I'll poke the snake because I'm not getting in the ring. He's a schmuck, all right? This guy's a loser, and if I had to bet, I would say you'd knock him out within 1.5 rounds.
Yeah, well, that's the goal. The quicker, the better. I'm working on a lot of things, though. Obviously defense, jab's important, obviously. The footwork's incredible. You have to make sure your footwork's correct because you don't want to trip over your own feet or just become a nut. Real quick, this is kind of interesting, and this goes to show you how tough boxing is. When I first went into the gym, I was acting a little arrogant, and my trainer said, get in the ring. Put your wraps on. Let's get in the ring. He said, try and hit me. I'm not going to hit you. You try to hit me, though. And we danced around for a while, and, it's really hard. And he said to me, I said, well, my opponent's not going to be as good as you. And he said, well, how do you know? He said, you have to prepare for every fight the same way. And it'll just allow you to be in a better position if.
And that's great training. That's great training. Yeah. But the reality is Jersey Jerry, Mr. Union Worker, who talks on Twitter about how he misses the union work, but he gave it up voluntarily to go and take a cushy job at Barstool. Mm-hmm. This guy is a cream puff. He's a cream puff, all right? And you're going to knock the filling out of him within 90 seconds.
Yeah, I can't wait. I'm looking forward to it. As you said, it's going to be a great month of promo, and you're getting down there. And we'll talk about that towards the fight. I hope a lot of you check it out. It'll be your opportunity to see the big man on campus from the sit down take on Jersey Jerry.
I can't wait. I can't wait to see you knock the spit out of this guy's mouth.
Well, as you know, and I've told you, we have a mob connection to the walkout in this. So
that's right.
We'll have to talk more about that towards we get closer. But everything's going great. I'll be back in the gym on Tuesday. Okay, let's get into Mad Sam DeStefano. Not a crazy long one, but definitely one filled with plenty of info. So let's get into it. Sam DeStefano on the sit down. Samuel DeStefano Jr. was born September 13th, 1909 in Streeter, Illinois. Now, Streeter is about 80 miles from Chicago. It was a coal town. And this is what you would find in Illinois in the 10s and 20s. These little towns bereft of much industry outside of the coal mines. And when Sam was born, his family was a big one. They had 10 children. And Sam's father was a laborer. He was always looking for coal work. And when Sam was 2 months old, they'd actually moved the family to a town called Herron, Illinois. Herron is not real far from the town of Streeter. Small little town, not far from Chicago. And it was at the time a place that had a mine. So Sam's father would go to work in the Herron mine. Keep in mind, Sam's parents actually came over in 1903 from Italy. So they had been in the country for about 6 years before they had all their children. Now, being a co-worker wasn't easy. It was a dirty, tough job, but he did his best, Sam Sr., to provide for his family. The problem would come, though, when Sam was a young teenager, around 13 in 1922, a labor dispute would happen at the Herron mine, and there would be a massacre where 21 people would be killed. All sorts of terrible things went on, and luckily Sam's father survived, but it was a big reason for their move to Chicago. He really just couldn't get it right. His father struggled with getting legitimate work, and he finally had some, and then he had to give it up after this big labor dispute. So Sam's family would move to Little Italy in Chicago, which at the time was really a ghetto. It is where a lot of Italians settled. It was another area bereft of anything quality. Jobs were scarce. There were hoodlums everywhere. But as we know, and as we've heard time and time again, there were some people in suits in the neighborhood that seemed to get a lot of respect. And as a young teenager, Sam DeStefano would be very much in all of those people. But, you know, kind of a different life than we've noticed with a lot of these guys, Blackjack. Sam DeStefano's father was, by all accounts, a pretty hardworking, decent guy.
Yeah, I mean, he was a hardworking guy, but I think it's a product of the times more than anything else, Jeff. You know, you talk about, you know, this era in American history in the 20s. It's hard to find good work for people during this time. You know, we have a looming depression. The economy isn't good. We have a ton of immigration coming into the country from Europe. It's just, I think a lot of these guys during this period are a product of their times. There wasn't a lot of work to be had, and the work there was to be had wasn't particularly good. So family struggle. I mean, even if like you said, Sam DeStefano's father was a hardworking guy, they still struggled. It wasn't a question of desire or work ethic. It was just the way things were in this country at the time that it was a hard time to make ends meet.
Now, Sam had a couple of brothers, one of which, Mario, would follow him into the life. He was actually born in 1915. So Sam was older by about 6 years. And, you know, Mario looked up to his brother. He also had another brother, Michael, who would also follow them into the life. Now, interesting thing about Michael, and we'll get into some of his exploits later, but Michael DeStefano was set out of the group to be the one that was soft. His brother, Sam, and obviously Mario both had the gene in them where, you know, they were hardcore gangsters. But Michael did have the kind of softness in him, and that would be something that would be something that will come back to hurt him down the road. During the 20s, obviously Chicago was a hellscape, I guess you could say.
Yep.
There was prohibition in full force. There were gang wars everywhere. And for young children and young teenagers, especially in places like Little Italy, you know, there was crime everywhere. And Sam would quickly in his teens get into that. By 1926, he was hanging out with hoodlums. He'd even be arrested by 1926 for breaking out of a jail for a minor offense. So he was already getting into things. But by 1927, he was hanging out with a couple different guys, including an individual called Harry Cosgrovey. He would also hang out with his brothers, Michael and Mario, and another guy called Ralph Orlando. Now, in 1927, Sam is, you know, 18 years old. He's young. He's brash. You know, decent looking kid, you know, in good shape. But he had always said, and this had been said since he was a teenager, he had always had these weird sexual deviant types of behaviors. And in November of 1927, he and an individual, an associate, Ralph Orlando, would have an idea where they wanted a night of fun for them and the buddies. So they decide to go down to the movie district, the theater district, and they pick out a girl and kidnap her. She was 17 years old. They would throw her into a car and drive her to a garage where he, Ralph Orlando, and five other individuals managed to rape her. They took turns. Now, everyone got to, you know, take a chance here and do what they had to do. As DeStefano prepared to have his chance, the police busted in and arrested Orlando and DeStefano. Now, Orlando had already committed rape and was sentenced to 10 years in prison. DeStefano would get a little shorter sentence, but he would get 3 years in prison. So by 18, Blackjack, this guy was all basically a convicted rapist. I guess we can say he wasn't a rapist because he never actually did it, but he was in a conspiracy to rape someone and someone that was underage as well. This guy was a disturbing individual very early.
Yeah, I mean, listen, this is as bad of a scenario as you can imagine, right? I mean, we're talking about a gang rape that, as you said, Sam DeStefano did not complete his part in it, but he was more than willing to. You know, this is a grotesque scenario for somebody as young as he is to be taking part in, for anybody to really be taking part in. But this kind of sets the stage for what you're going to get out of Sam DeStefano.
Yeah, and once Sam gets out in 1930, he is still running the streets. And look, Prohibition had created these little smaller factions, little street gangs, and farm teams for the mob, which we've seen before. And one of the groups that's created is the 42 Gang. It was a teenage gang that would really run the streets of Chicago. And you know, this eventually would produce a lot of different mobsters that would graduate to becoming outfit members, including Phil Aldiserio, Louis Frado, you know, Mad Sam DeStefano, Sam Giancana, Fifi Buccieri, a lot of different mobsters in Chicago would start out as part of the 42 Gang. And they would do petty crimes. They would rob people. They would commit burglaries, thefts, bank robberies, sexual assaults, and even murder. They were enforcers. They were a farm team. They were younger groups that would do the dirty work for the outfit. And again, ultimately, the University of Chicago would determine that over 30 members would be killed, seriously wounded, or imprisoned at one point. So this was a busy group. They were hoodlums, they were criminals, and Sam would join this crew. And this is where he would meet Sam Giancana, and this would be a huge connection for a lot of his life. One thing about Sam DeStefano that made him who he was always someone, he wasn't smart, he was actually quite moronic, actually, but he met a lot of smart and you know, more experienced people that had connections, one of which was Sam Giancana. He would often meet Paul Rica as well. But their 42 Gang, the big thing they did was they wore white fedoras, which was a sign of they were 42 Gang. And the 42 Gang stood for the fact that there were 42 members, including Mario and Sam DiStefano. By 1933, Sam was a big-time criminal. He had already served a stretch for rape, as we talked about, in Stateville Prison. But in 1933, one of the crimes that the 42 Gang was notorious for was robbing banks. Sam and associates would go to Wisconsin, where they would attempt to rob a bank called the New Lisbon State Bank. Now, initially, the bank blackjack robbery would be successful, but they got really unlucky in the car chase. The car would break down, and this would be a big problem, obviously. Sam would be arrested and ultimately convicted that year of bank robbery and get 40 years. This was obviously a brutal sentence. He would go to jail. Luckily, though, he would get a little bit of a reprieve. In 1942, after serving about 9 years, the governor of Chicago, a man called Julius Heel, would commute his sentence and he would be released. So he did about 10 years for a bank robbery. And again, we've seen this before as well. We saw this with Carmine Persico, never properly paid for his crimes. And if the criminal justice system was just a bit better, people like Sam Giancana probably wouldn't have become what they were. Can we look back on all of this, Blackjack, when we finish the show and say, if the criminal justice system was better, people like Sam DiStefano probably wouldn't have been on the street?
I mean, I think you're right about that. My only critique with what you're saying is that the criminal justice system did its job, right? Like, they sentenced him to 40 years in prison. My question is, what possesses Governor Julius Heel to pardon this guy after 10 years? Like, there had to be external pressures and or bribes to go to a governor to pardon somebody with 30 years left on their sentence. Like, the justice system did what it was supposed to do, right? Like, they convicted him, they sentenced him, he was supposed to go away, he went away. And then this governor comes out of nowhere and says, nah, we're just going to let the next 30 years go. Like, what led to that is my question.
This episode of The Sit Down is powered by BetterHelp. We're all looking for a way to improve ourselves, whether it's our mental health, our physical health, really health in general. The one of the best resources I can honestly recommend is BetterHelp. Something preventing you from achieving your goals? What interferes with your happiness? Why aren't you happy? We need you to be happy. Life is about happiness. And it's time to get familiar with BetterHelp. BetterHelp will help you assess your needs and match you with your own licensed professional therapist. Connect in a private online environment in up to 48 hours. It can go quick and go fast. We can get you on board with someone that can help you quick. It's not a crisis line. It's a self-help line, but it's professional counseling done securely online. You can send a message to your counselor anytime, and they have licensed professional counselors who specialize in everything from depression, anxiety, relationships, sleeping, grief, anger, really whatever your issue is. BetterHelp's got you covered and can help you out. Anything you share is confidential. It's convenient, professional, and affordable. Look, as many of you know, I lost a lot of weight recently. Not only has it helped my physical health, but it's helped my mental health. And there are some things that on a personal level I like to get help with. I advise go get BetterHelp now. I want you to start living a healthier life today, just like I have. As a listener, you get 10% off your first month by visiting our sponsor at betterhelp.com/sitdown. Again, join over 1 million people who have taken charge of their mental health. Again, that's betterhelp.com/sitdown. Using the internet is one of the most common things we do in our everyday life. It's now time for you to protect your privacy online, and look no further than NordVPN. What is a VPN? VPN is a virtual private network, and it's a service that allows to protect your internet connection and privacy online. It creates an encrypted tunnel for your data, protects your online identity by hiding your IP address, and allows you to use public Wi-Fi spots safely. And we've partnered with NordVPN And they're going to give you a hell of a deal as we head in to Black Friday. By using the code SITDOWN at checkout, you are going to get up to 73% off your NordVPN plan, plus a bonus gift as well. Right now, by going to nordvpn.com/sitdown, that's nordvpn.com/sitdown, you're going to get up to 73% off your total order. Now, I know for me, I like to watch TV. I like to check out different things. I like to surf the internet undetected. You can get VPNs really from anywhere in the world, and it makes things so easy to protect yourself online. Again, using the internet now, it's like a common thing we do. And this service, it pays for itself. It's equivalent to buying a cup of coffee every month, a small price to pay for your premium cybersecurity and access to vast amounts of entertaining content. Keep in mind, there's a 30-day money-back guarantee if the service isn't for you, and there's no risk. So do what I did. Go to NordVPN and get in the game today. Again, remember, by going to nordvpn.com/sitdown, you're going to get up to 73% off your first order. Go get involved. NordVPN, protect yourself online. Well, look, as we know about, you know, particularly Chicago, and I would imagine in Illinois in general, it seems like a pretty corrupt state. I know Chicago is pretty corrupt. I know, obviously, Rod Blagojevich many years later. They've definitely had their fair share of concerns. But look, this guy was a one-term mayor, so or governor, so, you know, maybe that will lend his terms. He would only do that four-year term. So he would actually be relieved in 1943 after he would lose an election to Orland Loomis. So Sam would get out in 1944, and this was at the height of World War II. And as we know, and we've talked about this before, during the World War, we began to ration things in this country. Everything was rationed, whether it was bread, whether it was gas, whether it was sugar, everything was rationed. You could only buy it with ration stamps. Sam DiStefano gets a job, a straight job out of prison at a lottery ticket printer. So he goes in, learns how to print things, and gets an idea to start counterfeiting fake ration sugar stamps. Eventually he starts selling them, making some money. But he gets jammed up and goes to prison. The FBI, or not the FBI, but the United States sentences him to 1 year in federal prison, and he goes off to Leavenworth. Now, before his conviction, he actually gets married. He marries a girl called Anita, and they would ultimately have a few children. And we'll talk about her a little bit later and some of the behavior that she would put up with as well. But Sam would head off to Leavenworth, and this is where he would make kind of the foray into the outfit. This is where he would meet Paul Rica. And look, if you know anything about Chicago, you know all about Paul Rica. Paul Rica and Tony Accardo were really the brains behind taking the outfit from a street gang under Al Capone and really under Frank Nitti. When Frank Nitti became boss after Capone, Paul Rica and Tony Accardo were the ones really making the decisions. They took the outfit from a gang to Blackjack, a criminal organization and a mafia. Paul Rica was from Naples. He actually came up working under the Camorra in Italy. So this guy had been in the life really forever. And we'll do a show on Paul Rica, but was incredibly powerful, was incredibly shrewd, was incredibly connected. And he meets Sam DiStefano in jail. Sam would also meet an individual called Louis Little New York Campagna, and they would kind of be the brains in teaching Sam not only about the life, but he would learn how to become a juice lender. Now, for the layperson, a juice lender is a loan shark in the grand scheme of things. Now, juice loans generally are a bit higher interest-wise, but Sam would learn in a year enough for a lifetime. And he'd really Blackjack make his foray into the outfit.
Yeah, I mean, it's, as you said, it's kind of like a crash course, right? Into you know, learning what it takes to be successful in that outfit in Chicago at that time. So it's as good of an education as Sam DiStefano was going to get.
Yeah. By 1947, he would be released and he'd work in civil service, but it didn't last too long. He would actually begin putting money on the street, and Sam DiStefano would receive basically front money in 1948 to begin his loan sharking career. Look, it's pretty simple. When you live in a place like Chicago or any major city, a city, as we said, that's bereft of really jobs and any success, really, you need money. People become bookies. Maybe they become, drug addicts. You know, they owe money. They need money. And Sam was there to give them money. It's pretty simple. He gives you $2,000 and you pay him back each week with interest. And he was charging up to 25% interest. If you don't pay, you deal with Sam DiStefano. And we'll get into the fact that he actually enjoyed a lot of this stuff. But he was charging money. He was making a lot of money. And there were a ton of people that needed it. By the early 1950s, Sam would become one of the most important loan sharks in Chicago. He was prominent. He was using funds that Paul Rica would front him, and he turned it into a pretty legit business. Now, it would often come where, let's say someone couldn't pay, and they would have to deal with Sam DiStefano. He would also take money that he would earn through robbing banks and began investing it in legit properties, real estate buildings. And he would also use it to bribe politicians, cops, and other prominent people in the city. Now, there were some methods that Sam DiStefano would use. A lot of the time when you become a loan shark, the goal is you want to lend to people that will pay you back. You're not going to lend to some high-risk guy, Blackjack, that's not going to pay you. Sam DiStefano was known to give money to anybody. So whether it was a businessman, whether it was a drug addict, whether it was a bookie, whether it was a prostitute, it didn't matter. If you needed money, Sam DiStefano would give it to you. And Sam DiStefano would quickly develop a reputation that if you did not pay, you would have to go down to what people would call a torture chamber he would build in his home. He would also, at one point, people would say that he would foam at the mouth while torturing people. He was beginning to enjoy doing this sort of thing. He would also at certain points kill people for small sums to basically scare higher end debtors to make sure they paid. One of the things he was also doing that would add to his growing fortune is he would go to people and say, look, you have an assault case. I have people in my pocket. You pay me, I'll hit you with juice and I'll get you off of this. So he would charge, like, if you got a robbery charge, he'd charge you to get you off. And at one point, the cops were actually escorting suspects right to DiStefano's home where they would create the juice loan process and he would assist in getting them off. So he was creating, by making these connections in local government, he found that politicians were crooked, cops were crooked, and as long as you paid them a little scot-all, they were willing to look the other way. So he was making a lot of money. And even with some of his torturous antics, Blackjack, the outfit really was putting up with him because he made them a lot of money.
Yeah, I mean, he figured out, I don't want to say a loophole in the system, but, you know, he figured out the weak points, right? He figured out that you could apply pressure to cops. You could apply pressure to the people that the cops were arresting. And if you could do that in conjunction with one another, you could essentially work both ends of the system against itself and make money. It really is kind of a genius way to go about it.
Yeah. And, you know, again, ultimately, the outfit was willing to put up with him because I think they knew he was a bit of a lunatic, but, you know, they put up with him because he was a moneymaker. And by 1955, Sam DiStefano was one of the leading loan sharks in Chicago, but he would start to have some personal problems with family members. By 1955, his brother, who we mentioned, Michael, was soft. He began using drugs and he became a drug addict. The higher echelon of the outfit began to realize that maybe he was a bit of a liability. And they would tell Sam DiStefano that, hey, look, you're his brother. He's got to go. Now, look, whether you say Sam DiStefano was a disturbed person, he was he a lunatic? Yes. But he loved his family. He was very close to his brothers. But this guy was an addict. He was a heroin addict. He was a liability. So they tasked Sam DiStefano with killing his own brother. And in 1955, his body would be found. He was shot multiple times. Sam DiStefano would be questioned about this murder, but he would, quote, giggle and laugh uncontrollably when asked about it. Definitely kind of a sadistic behavior for sure. But he killed his own brother. That's the kind of guy that Mad Sam DiStefano was. Not really a laughing matter, but it actually gets worse with this guy. By the 1960s, as I've said, he was a leading loan shark in the city of Chicago. And he was doing all sorts of different crimes as well. I do want to kind of get in quickly to some of the odd behavior that Sam DiStefano would exhibit. I mentioned some of the odd and quite deviant sexual proclivities that he had. He also had some weird behavior. He would, quote, drive to pig farms for hours just to watch them. He would park and really just sit there and gawk over pigs, and said that it was his dream to own a pig farm so he could feed his victims to them. Definitely concerning.
Bizarre.
Yeah. He also would tell mob informant Charles Cromartie that he once forced his wife, Anita, to take a gun and put the end of the barrel in his mouth and demanded that she pull the trigger. Oftentimes during sex, when she pulled the trigger and the gun didn't go off, he would begin to laugh and told her he removed the bullets. And he would repeatedly tell a mob associates this as a funny story. There was also a situation where he did some things with coffee beans, which we'll get into here in just a second. He was also said to be a devil worshiper. According to a rogue cop called Tommy Dorso, Dorso would say that he once saw DiStefano roll on the floor with spit and foam running out of his mouth, begging Satan to show him mercy, screaming over and over again, "I am your servant, command me." He was a weird, weird guy. He was also described as being a highly emotional, temperamental individual who was extremely egotistical and concerned with his personal appearance. He was said to have many mirrors throughout his home, and he would at one point laugh, the next minute cry, the next minute be furious. And he also said that if he had not been framed for rape at age 17, he would, quote, have become the president of the United States. He was very weird. It's that simple. He was a bizarre, bizarre person.
I don't know how you can take these things that you've just laid out, and they're all factual, and conclude anything other than Sam DiStefano was seriously mentally ill. I mean, I don't know how the conclusion can be anything else, right? Like, he would sit for hours at pig farms and watch pigs and think about feeding people to them. He put a gun in his wife's mouth, you know, with allegedly no bullets in it, and pulled the trigger. You know, he talked the coffee thing, which we'll get to, which is in and of itself a crazy thing. Like, I don't, the fact that when they confront him about murdering his brother, he just laughs uncontrollably. This is all of the indicia of somebody who is seriously mentally ill.
Yeah, there's also a story one time where he and his wife get into an argument and he went out for a drive. He would see a man walking down a Chicago street. He would force the man into his car at gunpoint. He would then take the man to his home and force the individual at gunpoint to have sex with his wife. He would then take the guy into his car and leave him and tell him to leave. The man was so disgusted and disturbed that he would go to the nearest police station and report the incident, but they wouldn't believe what he was telling them. This guy was a real weirdo, man. I mean, real fucking weirdo. Definitely the weirdest person, really, that I've come across. By the early 60s, Sam DiStefano was starting to get a real reputation, though, as a major lunatic psychopath from a murder standpoint. He would get into a beef with an individual called Art Adler. Adler owned a restaurant in Chicago called the Trade Winds, and he would borrow money from Sam DiStefano. Time would come where it was time to pay it back, and he wasn't able to take care of it. So DiStefano said, well, let's just get rid of him. He would torture Adler for days, and he would manage to strangle him to death. The problem was Before he would be strangled to death, Adler would have a heart attack, and he would die from simultaneous heart attack and strangulation. He would then take the body and put it in a sewer, and it would be found frozen solid. And this is where the cops would start to understand who Sam DeStefano was. An FBI agent called Bill Romer began to question him about not only this murder, but just his overall business and what he was a part of and how he made his money. At one point, he would go to his home. DeStefano's wife would yell up to DeStefano that someone was there to see him. Sam would walk down the stairs in his pajamas and pull his pants down and run around the room, exposing himself to the agent. He would also masturbate in front of the officers. And in one situation, he began offering the cops coffee. And one agent would discuss that the coffee kind of was a unique taste, but Sam would just say that it were special Italian coffee beans that his wife would brew. Months later, Romer would find out that DeStefano actually had been urinating in the coffee before giving it to them. Romer would say that from that point on, he would never drink coffee again. So not only was Sam being a lunatic, but he was making a fool out of the FBI. This is just really maniacal behavior. I will admit that's kind of funny, but just kind of disgusting,
frankly. If the coffee bean thing were the only thing on his
it wouldn't be as weird.
Crazy, I would agree with you, and I would say it's kind of funny, right? Like you're pissing the FBI's coffee.
Right.
But the problem is you take into account all of the other stuff, right? Kidnapping someone and forcing them to have sex with your wife, putting a gun in your wife's mouth, you know, laughing uncontrollably when they're confronting you about killing your own brother, masturbating in front of them. Like this goes beyond, like, you know, we've talked about people in this, on this series, about people who have tried to act like they're crazy or act like they're something else, you know, Chin Gigante, you know, Mr. Neal dressing up like a priest. This is not that. This is a guy who is not, he does not have the full complement of marbles, Jeff.
No, he definitely had some real screws loose upstairs. He also was developing a reputation in the outfit. Frank Culotta, who was, he actually died a couple of years ago. He was actually one of the bases of a casino. Frank Culotta was a mobster in the outfit. He would actually talk about many years later just how weird Sam DeStefano was and how, frankly, people didn't fuck with him. He told the story that he one night walked into a bar and DeStefano was at the bar with some of his people. And he walked in with his people and they, you know, said hello to each other. And Sam at the time was talking to a, according to him, a beautiful woman. She became disenchanted with his conversation and kind of pushed him. Sam was said to grab her and take her in front of the whole restaurant and force her into a bathroom. At that point, Culotta kind of jumps up and his guy says, stop, do not fuck with him. People were scared of him. And I guess according to Culotta, he took her into the bathroom and she would come out crying a minute or two later. And I guess DeStefano raped her. But this is the kind of guy that he was. I mean, he was pretty feared. A lot of people thought he was a guy that had screws. And I think we are beginning to understand why they thought that. Obviously, with such a big juice loan operation and as much money he was making, he would need collectors. One of the collectors that he had was a guy called William Action Jackson. Jackson was, according to the police, a man with the body of a giant and the brain of a child. His job was basically to scare people. He was a huge individual, 6+ foot, 300+ pounds, and a real lunatic in his own right. It was said at one point, Black Jake, that one of Jackson's methods for extracting money from people was not by force. He would not beat people up. He would not hurt people. He would rape the wives and girlfriends of debtors. In one situation, mob lore would state that he once raped a woman and did such terrible things to her that he bit the nipple of her off.
Jesus Christ.
That's a mob lore. It's been said and talked about. I've actually talked about it to a couple of people that I respect in the business that they've said they've heard the same things. This guy was really just a bad guy, and he fit perfectly with Sam DeStefano's operation. But this individual, William Jackson, would be arrested in 1961. And Bill Romer, who was investigating DeStefano, would try to flip Jackson. Jackson declined and, you know, leaves. The problem was the outfit found out about it. And Tony Accardo and the different ruling body says, look, Jackson's a rat. He's got to go. So DeStefano, Tony Spilotro, and other members of the outfit kidnap Jackson. They would take him to an unknown location and torture him for 3 days. They would do various terrible things to him, including stripping him naked, smashing him in his kneecaps with bats, hammers, and other instruments. They would break his ribs, stab him with sharp objects, including an ice pick. They would also do really awful things, like use a cattle prod on his penis, as well as an ice pick. And they also would shove, quote, a large metal rod where it shouldn't go. They would also burn parts of his body, including his penis and balls, with a blowtorch, and told him they were going to kill his wife and children if he did not confess. 3 days into it, he would succumb to his wounds and die. His body would be recovered in his Cadillac Eldorado on Lower Wacker Drive in Chicago on August 12, 1961. In my opinion, this is the most graphic mob murder of all time. Yeah. There have been a lot of bad ones, but this one was incredibly graphic. And after the fact, the FBI would pick up a very sickening wiretap conversation between an individual called Jackie Cerrone and another individual called Fifi Bucheri. Bucheri was said to be involved with the murder, and he would laugh to Cerrone about how Jackson would be impaled basically on a metal rod, and that he was so fat that he couldn't sit for very long. And they would laugh about the fact that he would, you know, soil himself and all sorts of things. It was just a really sickening event. And all in all, it was pretty much proven that he was not an informant. They killed him for very little reason. This was just a really disgusting event. You would agree that, I mean, we've talked about a lot of awful crimes, but I mean, this was a pretty sickening event.
I mean, that's as barbaric gets.
Now, keep in mind, William Action Jackson was an awful individual himself.
No doubt.
And real quick, there was a book called The Outfit written. And according to the author, there are people that believe that not only he was killed for becoming a rat, or supposed to becoming a rat, but from what people say, he was believed to rape an individual, Murray Humphrey's wife, I guess. So there was also, look, he was a bad guy. He got a bad end, but that's a pretty grisly murder.
It's as barbaric gets. You mentioned at the top of this show, guys like Kabani Savage. The only thing I can compare it to is, you know, the Kabani Savage street crew burning down the house with people in them, including children. That's the only thing that rivals this one. This is as barbaric a killing as we've talked about.
Yeah, I definitely would agree. I think the only thing that really gets close to this is Anthony Casso attempting to kill the sister of Fat Peter Chiodo, who had literally nothing to do with anything, but they didn't torture her. It was obviously terrible, but yeah, this is just a really sickening event. By 1963, DeStefano, it would also be involved in other very high-profile murders, including the murder of an individual called Leo Foreman. Foreman was a high-end real estate agent who began borrowing money from Sam DeStefano. Now, obviously, he didn't get a huge point that, hey, when you borrow money from DeStefano, you better pay it back. So DeStefano goes to deal with Foreman and say, you know, what's up with the money, blah, 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 blah. Foreman basically goes into a rage and says, get the fuck out of here. I'll pay you when I can, blah, 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 and goes into hiding. As we know with DeStefano, you're not going to get away with that. So not only would he, but his underling, Tony Spilotro and Chucky Grimaldi, would find Foreman and say that, you know, DeStefano said, hey, things are good. Everything's fine. I'm sorry I flipped out, but it was all bullshit. They would basically accost him. And this was a particularly grisly murder as well. They would beat him to death with hammers, stab him 20 times with an ice pick, and then shoot him in his head. And he was found in the trunk of his car days later. He was also completely out of control, as we know. And this is where the outfit continues and starts to get sick of Sam DeStefano. His behavior was out of control. I think they were starting to realize closely that other people could do what he was doing. There were other people that were involved in the juice loan business. And look, he would ultimately, and we'll get into what he would do to get people really disgusted and sick of him. But he would also be involved in one other murder of an individual called Peter Capoletti. Capoletti was like William Action Jackson, a collector. And he decides in a real wild decision to go collect 25 grand from a victim and flee. So he decides, hey, fuck Mad Sam, I'm out. I'm just going to take the money and run. DeStefano's men would locate him, though, in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, and put him in the trunk and take him back to Chicago. DeStefano would then chain him to a radiator and torture him for 3 days. Now, during all this, Sam had owned a restaurant above this torture chamber, and he would have a party for Capoletti. He would then basically strip Capoletti naked and show him in front of everyone, severely burned, and force his family to pay double what they owed. They also would urinate on him in unison. And quickly after the banquet, the family would pay back the stolen money. So not only was DeStefano someone that would do terrible things to people, but he'd also publicly embarrass them into paying more than they owed.
Yeah, I mean, we're talking about a guy here who just has no boundaries, right? I mean, there's no limitations on what he'll do physically, emotionally. I mean, it's a guy who is a loose cannon. And as you said, you know, the outfit is starting to grow tired of him because this behavior just can't be tolerated for that long, Jeff. If you're going to continually do shit like this, it is eventually going to bring a spotlight on you, which then brings that spotlight on those that you work for and with. This is an intolerable situation long term.
Yeah, and look, by 1964, not only was the outfit getting sick of Sam DeStefano, but the police were closing in on him. By 1964, he was really becoming a big-time focus of the FBI. He had a notorious reputation, and they would begin to lean on Sam DeStefano. But this wouldn't be the last erratic behavior he would have. In 1964, he would get jammed up on some election violations in the Chicago area. A lot of it had to do with corruption and that sort of thing. This would begin some bizarre behavior in court. During that trial, he would be rolled into the trial in a gurney with a blanket over him. As he was wheeled in, he would pull a bullhorn from underneath the blanket and begin screaming inside the courtroom, and he wouldn't stop. The judge would tell him multiple times to cut out the behavior, and at one point, the judge just got sick of it and hit him with contempt of court. He would be hit with contempt of court 3 different times, and this would become kind of a publicity stunt. He would start acting so bizarrely that the public started to find out who he was as well, which was a big problem. You don't want a lot of fanfare around the mafia. And they were basically, he was making the outfit lose a ton of credibility. He was a clown. You're going to let this guy represent what you're doing. He's having conversations with reporters. He's flying off the handle about all sorts of different things. He would also appear at court in pajamas. He continued to bring the bullhorn, talking about the American government, how they're corrupt. Just this stuff just couldn't go for too long. I mean, it's eventually not only the cops are going to get sick of it, but the outfit got sick of it. By the 1960s, And in 1964, he'd eventually get 3 years for contempt of court, and he would be silenced for a couple of years until the late 60s when he would get out. By that point, he had a lot of problems because his old friend, Chucky Cromalty, was actually a rat. He would flip and tell them everything, all about the Leo Foreman hit and some other hits that they had been a part of. The walls are closing in around Sam Giancana, or not Sam Giancana, Sam DiStefano. And the walls would really close in the early 70s. His old skipper, Paul Rica, the guy that he had known for many years and the guy that really kept him alive, I think, would die in October of 1972. So Paul Rica was the last line of defense for Sam DiStefano. He was the guy that probably said, look, don't kill him. He's a good earner, blah, 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 blah. But once he died, Blackjack, it was really just a matter of time.
I mean, that's it. I mean, the guy had worn out his welcome as much as you possibly could. He was a loose cannon. He was a danger to everybody in the outfit. You get guys, and we've seen this, Jeff, time and time again. There's only so much you can tolerate of people like this before your time has come. And honestly, he probably outlasted his welcome.
Now, remember, when we look back at business, you know, Sam DiStefano was a big earner. He made a lot of money for the mob. But by 1972 and by Rica's death, Sam had been arrested for the Leo Foreman murder. And he would eventually post bail and get out. The problem was the case was solid. They had an informant. He was probably going to go to jail and probably get life. But in 1973, Tony Accardo wouldn't let him go to trial. He would sanction a hit on Sam DiStefano. Now, it wouldn't be easy, though, because by this point, DiStefano had realized that, you know, he's been watched by the cops. There's not a lot of wiggle room here. And the only one that could really get close to him was his brother, Mario DiStefano. And remember, Sam had killed his brother about 20 years before. But Tony Accardo and the outfit go to Mario DiStefano and say, look, your brother is a fucking liability at this point. You know it. We know it. He's a psychopath. He's got to go. So they would task Tony Spilotro and Mario DiStefano, his own brother, with killing him. They would come up with an elaborate scheme where they would tell Sam that they had Chucky Cromaldi. By this point, Cromaldi was someone that I don't think Sam DiStefano had any person he'd rather kill over Cromaldi. This was the lightning rod between him and going to prison. So he would jump at the opportunity to kill Cromaldi. Keep in mind, though, it was all bullshit. They would attempt to pick Sam up at his home on the 1600 block of North Sayre Avenue. Now, that was in Elmwood Park. And Sam was under the auspice that he would get to kill Cromaldi finally. On April 14th, 1973, his brother and Tony Spilotro would walk up his Elmwood Park home as he walked out of the garage. And as he appeared under the garage door, Spilotro would pull a shotgun out and shoot him once. It would hit him in the left arm and blow his arm off, clear off. By that point, he then followed it up with a second shot and blew it through his chest. Sam DiStefano would die on April 14, 1973, right in front of his home. It was interesting because that day, a huge crowd developed outside of his home. He laid lifelessly in the front of his garage. And at one point, there's a very interesting audio bite where you can hear his wife running up and she screams, "Sam, Sammy, oh, Sammy." And that was that. Sam DiStefano was no more. His funeral would be held at the Galewood Chapel. And according to mob lore, no mobster would show up. By this point, they were sick and tired of DiStefano. He wasn't respected anymore. And look, once the mob grows tired of you, once you become a public spectacle, once you become greedy and not willing to share, once you become just someone that won't listen, you become expendable. And sometimes they have to go to people that know you best. The Stefanos were wild people, but a brother for a brother. And that's kind of how it was looked at. Mario DiStefano actually would get arrested for the Leo Foreman hit as well. He would ultimately be convicted of that hit and get 20 to 40 years in state prison. However, the sentence would be overturned by the Illinois Appellate Court in 1975, and he would get a new trial. However, it wouldn't matter. He would die on August 12th, 1975 of a heart attack. Now, Tony Spilotro, we will do a show on. He obviously deserves his own show, and we'll do that very soon. We'll talk about his life as well. But Blackjack, you know, the book closes on DeStefano, and I think we can surely look back and say he was surely the weirdest, most bizarre person in the history of the mob. He was a good earner. He made a lot of money. He used tactics that were great for collecting that money. And the outfit loved him. And at one point, even put money on the street with him because he was so successful. But by the end of it, Tony Accardo didn't get where he was by allowing Mad Sam DeStefano to run amok. He just became a permanent pariah in the game. And that was that.
Yeah, I mean, listen, you can get knocked out of this life by greed. You can get knocked out by bringing on too much attention. You can get knocked out by just being too much to handle. Sam DeStefano was all of the above, right? He was too much attention because of the outrageous shit he was doing. He was taunting the FBI. You can't do that. He was greedy. And he was also just such a bizarre guy to deal with. Like, imagine dealing with this guy on a day-to-day basis. Like, nobody wants to deal with a wild card every day of the week. And that's what Sam DeStefano was. And ultimately, it's what led to his downfall.
Yeah, I mean, again, the mob wants these lunatic maniacs. But when you become this, you know, maniacal...
Uncontrollable lunatic.
Yeah. When you become this, you know, maniacal and out of control, it's only a matter of time. But interestingly enough, his own brother killed him after he killed his own brother many years before.
Seems about so, right.
That's the story on the DeStefanos, including Sam DeStefano. Definitely a top three biggest lunatic in the history of the mob. I'll ask you, though, Blackjack, you'd have to agree that if something needs done, he'd probably be the guy to take care of it.
I don't doubt he would take care of it, but I think you could probably find someone else to take care of it with a lot less crazy involved.
Yeah, I guess you could just be Tommy Patera, chop the body up, get rid of it.
Correct.
There's no need for all that torture.
No, there's not. You know, Jeff, there are lines, right? We've talked about this over and over. There are lines. Like, there, sometimes you do what you got to do, but this guy just went so far above and beyond that it's hard to stomach for anybody.
Yeah, and we do apologize for the graphicness of this show, but we like to tell the truth and come with facts. As always, hope you enjoyed the show. Make sure you hit us on Twitter at The Sit Down 7. We're also on YouTube, The Sit Down. It can be found there as well. I do some shorter videos there, which people like as well. And look, we want to hear from you. As always, make sure when you check out the show on iTunes, wherever you check it out, you give us a deserved rating and give us a review as well. Tell us what you think of the show. We'll continue with a very interesting show next week. Actually, next week, what we're going to do is we're going to talk about Apalachin, which the anniversary is next week of really the most famous mob meeting in the history of Cosa Nostra. This would be really the thing that would ultimately put the mob on the national radar.
Yep.
It was a huge meeting that was assembled and really involved really every heavyweight ever. We've got some great information on really what went down, how it went down, who got caught, who didn't. This took the veil off the mob. It's pretty simple.
That's good.
And everyone and everyone that was part of the mob was there. Russell Buffalino, Vito Genovese, Carlo Gambino, Santa Trafficante. Everyone and everyone was there. So we'll talk about that. Remember, that occurred on November 14th, 1957. So we'll talk about that next week. We'll also get closer and closer to my fight. And we'll keep it up here on The Sit Down. Blackjack, good to have you back, man. Nice to hear from you.
Yeah, buddy.
Make sure you check out Blackjack Fletcher on Twitter. You can find his account on our Twitter as well. Make sure you give him a follow. Blackjack, good to hear from you. Thanks for coming.
Can't wait for next week, brother.
Yep, we'll be back next week here on The Sit Down. Have a great week, and thanks for listening.